Any parent watching a child struggle with schoolwork will at least want to reach out for help. A little extra assistance can help a young student turn C's into B's or better. We'll spend this hour talking about students who are already doing well in school, earning A's, but spending extra time on schoolwork anyway. The process and the motivations for both students and parents are examined in a new book by Pawan Dhingra called Hypereducation: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. Pawan Dhingra is a sociologist and professor at Amherst College in Massachusetts. He's a former curator for the Smithsonian in Washington and the author of several books, including Beyond Bollywood: Asian Indian Americans Shape the Nation. Pawan Dhingra, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, we hear the stories of the overscheduled kids, and you reference these in your book as well, mm-hmm. You know, the ones who are going to soccer and ballet and taekwondo and all that stuff. How common is it, though, to have kids that are spending that extra time doing things like enrichment programs and extra special classes?
Right, that's a good question, because we normally think about the after school as being all these activities that don't take place in the school, and that's kind of the point, right? And yet we're seeing that a growing trend of parents enrolling their kids in an academic after-school program alongside soccer and ballet and taekwondo, and the overscheduling is growing. And this has been a trend that's been going on, some pockets here and there, but over the past, 4 or 5 years, it's actually become a national trend. And so we're seeing some of the fastest-growing companies in the country are tutoring companies. And these are available, online, in person. Where there's tutoring options in Grants Pass and Medford. You can hire one-on-one tutors anywhere. And so it's a trend that parents are saying, my school may be doing fine and my child is doing okay in school, but I still think that I want to make sure my child has advantages and can be competitive in the school. And so they're seeking out these extra opportunities. They could be math classes, they could be reading, things that are kind of easy to assess. Those are what you often see in terms of tutoring.
Okay, so, but and again, not to get kids up to grade level, they're already there. This is just to push them a little further ahead. So these are not cheap either. What kind of money do parents plunk down for tutoring and enrichment programs?
If you start a session, it can be about $150 to $200 a month, so not cheap at all. They're not extreme in terms of, they're way out of people's price range for middle-class families, but they're definitely for higher-income families. And that's one of the concerns around this, right? That those who can afford this and can organize their schedules around this and everything else are typically higher income families, and the education gap that we're already concerned about is just going to grow, right? So think of it this way, right? If we had a magic wand and we could make our schools, all equal in terms of their resources, in terms of the classrooms, in terms of the teaching and everything else, you would still see an education gap growing, because some have access to these, private companies and others won't. And that's another concern around this that we're worried about.
Now, this obviously gets into some ethnic and nationality undertones. It's not just Asian Americans, you point out, but is it heavily so?
It started off that way. And so in some parts of the country where you see a lot of Asian Americans, you'll see these kind of schools that are just, that they create for their own communities. And that was a story for a long time. And now it's actually a national story, because these are companies that are, franchises that are international or national spectrum companies that are quickly growing. And they're not just tapping into one demographic, right? They're looking at all kinds of families. I spoke to the directors of some of these, and they said, we actually target, areas where have, higher income families, it doesn't matter the ethnicity or the heritage, but we think those are the families that are already in good schools that parents will put the money into encouraging more education for their kids. So they're kind of playing off this idea. And one of the concerns around it is that teachers I spoke to see, increasing amounts of stress. They see increasing amounts of anxiety in kids because the kids feel added academic pressure. And I'm talking about second graders and third graders. I talked to one third grade teacher who said, I see students here who are nonverbal. Like, they're just really worried about their grades. And this is in third grade, right? And the parents aren't extreme. They're not driving home academics only. But it does create this extra sense of anxiety. And teachers are really the ones to speak out about this and are concerned about the youth.
Well, you know, you have to wade into some cultural stereotypes here. The idea of, you know, Asians work harder in school and all that, that anything less than an A is the Asian F or whatever. I'm glad you're approaching this from a sociologist's point of view. How do you separate truth from fiction in these realms?
Yeah, that's a good question. The whole, like, tiger parent notion out there is, and it's not as if there aren't tiger parents, right? There are, and it's not as if there aren't some ethnic differences. It's not a coincidence that, like I said, as you correctly brought up, that you do see some of these trends more pronounced in Asian immigrant families, because their parents, when they came to the U.S., oftentimes came here because they had achieved, you know, high amounts of education and quite well in education, and that's what let them come to the U.S. And beat out other people. So if that's how I got ahead, let's just say I got ahead because of high education and a really commitment to that, then as a parent, right, it just makes sense that I'm going to instill that same expectation onto my kids. And we see a similar theme with other kinds of extracurriculars. If I, you know, grew up playing a lot of baseball, I think it's a great way for kids to learn the sport and in teamwork and perseverance and be athletic, then I'm going to make sure my kid does baseball. And that's kind of the same kind of passing down what you know. So if what you know is education, and that's how you got ahead, and we see a lot of immigrants with that kind of background, then it makes sense we're going to see them kind of at the forefront of this phenomenon that's now becoming a national phenomenon.
Let's talk about some basics with what you call hyper-education. And you mentioned kids as young as second grade concerning their teachers because they seem stressed. Is that as young as it starts, or does it start even sooner than that?
It actually starts even sooner than that. There is programs designed for three-year-olds out there. I don't mean third graders. I mean three-year-olds, where they can learn, you know, patterns of dots and start learning how to read. That's a growing demographic that these companies are targeting. I even saw a child in a diaper at one of these learning centers. So they can be quite young. And second grade is by no means early to start getting involved.
I remember the diaper passes. That was quite a vivid image in the book. Yes, and it's amazing though. But so I mean, the parents are obviously thinking college pretty much from the time the kids are conceived, it sounds like. But when do kids, you find? I mean, did you talk to many kids? I mean, you talked to hundreds of people, it sounds like. Did you talk to kids about when they start thinking about college?
Yeah, I talked to a lot of kids, and they are not thinking about college at such a young age, but they are thinking about. Some of them actually quite enjoy this, right? Some kids really like learning more about math and learning more about, you know, science and spelling and reading and everything else. And so some parents are kind of following their kids' lead as opposed to dragging them to these spaces, and that's really wonderful. But so they're not really thinking about college so much as they're thinking about, you know, just getting ahead, enjoying what they do enjoy, or, you know, putting up with their parents who have to bribe them or threaten them to do this. I remember one mother saying, "My kid cannot go play soccer until he finishes his extra math homework." And that's not an uncommon kind of, you know, parenting technique. But what struck me in terms of what you're asking is parents' motivations is probably about getting them ready for college. But what also struck me was when I was talking with parents is how they were motivated by other things besides making their kids really academically competitive. One mother I spoke with, when I asked her, "Why are you doing this for your kid? Because you're in good schools and your kid's just fine, but they're a great child." She said, "My grandmother survived the Holocaust. My parents put me through college through hard work. I want my child to internalize those same values of hard work, of commitment, of perseverance, of kind of, you know, raising yourself up." And it really struck me that this was not about making her child better at math in this once-a-week math program or smarter or, you know, it wasn't about college at all. It was about a certain kind of moral kind of character and values she was trying to instill. She drew a line between the Holocaust survival and her kid's math class, right? And so there's a lot more going on in these parents' motivations that I learned beyond what we would imagine, right, on the surface.
Well, the question that would come to my mind then is, like, is doing well in school enough just by itself without this additional work?
That's one of the concerns that teachers I spoke to have and they shared, which is that there's an education arms race going on right now for younger and younger kids. Now, you know, if your kid is in trying to study for an AP test or an SAT test and gets extra help for that, you know, we may have different judgments about that, but we can understand that logic, where it's coming from. We're talking about children in middle school and younger, and again, these parents are not extreme. I don't want to paint them out to be extreme. They're very well-grounded and thoughtful and caring, but they're like, no, I want my child to have an extra academic advantage. And one of the implications and effects of that, that teachers I spoke to talked about, was this sense of insecurity that other kids would have in the classroom about, am I good enough in this subject if I'm just at grade level, when so-and-so in the class is above grade level because we're getting, you know, some extra help on the side. And so you have a lot of emotional implications well beyond the students who are actively doing it. This book is actually not so much for those who are doing private, but for all the families who aren't doing it, so we can understand what's going on and understand what's driving it and what's the implications and how to think about when is enough enough.
Yeah, I've heard educators talk about the value of heterogeneous grouping, so that the kids who are faster with the subject matter can kind of pull the rest of the class along with them. That you know, helps the
right
kids at the bottom as well as those in the middle. Are they thinking, though, the ones you're talking to in the terms you just mentioned, that the teachers that maybe the kids are just too far ahead of the class or something?
Partly it's that, and partly the teachers worry that instead of just pulling them along, they're doing is making them feel anxious if they're not already at the same level those kids are. One teacher I spoke to referred to it as, quote, academic bullying, the sense that if you're not doing really well and above grade level, then you're not adequate, right? And that's a concern that she's seeing. And I don't think, you know, teachers are really wary about bullying as an idea, and here she's referring it to academic bullying. Others I spoke to think that the parents who are doing this need to, you know, stop what they're doing and take a step back and parent differently. And I talk, and that was one of the major things I was trying to bring out in the text, which is helping teachers understand where parents are coming from and parents understand where teachers are coming from, because there's a huge disconnect there, right? Like teachers, one principal I spoke to said, parents who do this are uncaring and they're ungrounded. And yet the parents, when I spoke to them, felt that they didn't do this, they didn't get their kids a bit extra advantage, then they would be uncaring, right? So it's the complete opposite perspectives that the parents and teachers brought to this. And what I'm hoping to do is help shed light on both sides of that continuum.
Pavan Dhingra is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Hyper Education: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. I haven't asked about socioeconomic situations. Give us a sketch of the districts where this seems to be happening most often.
Yeah, these are in middle-class and upper-middle-class neighborhoods and districts. So, you know, we would think about tutoring, and this is how you started off the conversation, which is helping students who need help kind of getting up to grade level, or who are in school districts that, you know, the parents are really worried about. They may be underfunded or underperforming, and so they see tutoring as a way of compensating. And that's what we kind of think about tutoring. But this is not that anymore. And these places are growing intentionally and specifically in areas that are already well ahead of the kind of the national or the state average in terms of school rankings. These are typically, you know, middle class, upper middle class neighborhoods. I spoke with one person who said, you know, I target out my marketing materials to families who make over $100,000 a year, because that's where I think I get the most bang for my limited dollars, marketing dollars. You know, someone else mentioned that she's starting her education franchise in areas across the country that are already known for having well-ranked, well-resourced schools, because parents who move there, they're willing to put the money into extra education. And once some families do it, right, then other families feel compelled to also do it to catch up, to get to grade level, to catch up to those kids. And so it becomes like a domino effect that parents have to kind of do it because other parents are doing it. Then you have to stick with it because other parents are doing it. And it's a concern. Stress and anxiety were already concerns before this became a growing trend, and now we're seeing it really pronounced. And even during this current, if I may just quickly just add one more thing, this current COVID moment that we're in with remote learning, a lot of parents are worried that the schools aren't providing, you know, enough learning to their kids.
Sure.
You know, these tutoring centers and the like have really upped their online offerings. And so it's becoming even more of a draw than they would already be. Concerns around the COVID slide and the summer slide that were, you know, parents are already worried about.
Mm-hmm. Well, so how much is this motivated by fear? I mean, we're talking about the positive, you know, like I worked hard, I got a good education, I want you to get that, I want you to learn some work ethic. I mean, these are relatively positive things, but how much is, for example, fear of falling out of the middle class, which is a major American fear for the last few decades?
That's a really good point. And a lot of it is driven by the sense of fear, which is, and it's not just about fear of, not getting to an elite college or something like that. Again, these parents are not, you know, one-minded or single-minded in this extreme way, even though we may think of them that way. It's not true. They're everyday people who just are worried that unless their kids have an academic advantage, then they're going to end up risking being out of the middle class, not being able to maintain or the financial level they have, or grow to the next kind of step on that financial ladder. And this is what's really driving a lot of the concerns. And my advice, right, which I write a lot about, is if you parent out of fear, out of the sense of competition, then there's no end. There's no end to what you'll want to do. You won't be satisfied with how much your kids are learning, because you could always be learning more if that's your motivation. But instead of that, right, what I argue is that parents should be approaching their kids' learning as an opportunity to like grow from, as opposed to like a fear to like try to, you know, fill in. And by what I mean by opportunity is that parents should be, you know, hearing what are their kids talking about, what motivates their kids, what interests their kids, and then if they really want to add to their education outside of school, then find avenues that speak to their kids' interests and kind of grow from there. That will make the learning actually more enjoyable for the child. Because one of the concerns, right, is not just the stress and anxiety and the time commitment, but that learning becomes a chore if it's seen as something I just have to get done on top of whatever else I'm doing. Like, I have to sweep the floor, I have to make the bed, I have to do this extra learning. And that's what we want to avoid, right? We want to create lifelong learners. And this can be a way of doing it, depending on your kid's interest, but it could also backfire.
This is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is Pavan Dhingra, sociologist and professor at Amherst College in Massachusetts, written several books. His latest is a look at education and the places where parents push their children to not just do as well as they can, but better than they're already doing, pushing their A's even higher. His book is called Hyper Education: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. You can join our conversation on the Exchange. Share some thoughts about this. Talk about parents you've known who did this, or maybe you do it. Tell us why. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to get into some of the ethnic areas we were talking about before, because it seems like one of the responses that you get from not just teachers, but from actual school districts gets into these zones where even smart people talk about things like, well, you know, we have to keep up with the Asians.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I heard a lot about. And talked with a lot of the white families that I spoke to, U.S.-born whites who, you know, feel very comfortable with their lifestyle and everything else, started worrying about their kids' academics because there were Asian Americans in their school, kids' schools, who were doing this, or at least perceived to be doing this. And so there's this term called the new white flight, which is happening in certain, it's not common, but you see it here and there, where certain white families are leaving districts that have lots of Asian immigrants in them, out of this concern. But those who aren't leaving kind of feel this sense of having to keep up. And so they will double down on these educational things, even though that's not really where they would ideally put their emphasis, but they're worried their kids aren't going to be up to these up to the level of these other kids if they don't do it. And one thing I kind of write about is, you know, part of this trend of this educational tutoring growth is from these immigrant families doing this. But at the same time, we're seeing this trend grow in areas where there are very few immigrants as well. And these tutoring companies actually got a lot of money in growth from No Child Left Behind, that federal education act from many years ago. Mm-hmm. And they gave them billions of dollars to tutoring. And it was designed for tutoring for kids who were lower income or in schools that were underperforming. But one of the results was that these tutoring companies received lots of money, so they kind of grew in their locations and their offerings, and then so families who were middle class, who could afford without getting the federal kind of help, sort of saying, oh, maybe I should do this too. Maybe I should be part of this and help my kid. And so what started off as, we think of it as an immigrant kind of phenomenon, and again, there are pockets of this across the country. The real story that I write about is how it's a national trend that has roots in No Child Left Behind. It ties to, you know, families' concerns around middle class, maintaining their position, which, you know, in our current moment of increasing economic insecurity is no light concern. It's a pretty major concern.
Well, you point out that there are events like Spelling Bees and other events that are limited just to South Asian kids, but then you also point out that mm-hmm. it sounds like there are some parents who resist the cultural stereotypes and don't want to be labeled along with all those overly striving Asians or whatever the terminology might be, and choose not to put their kids in enrichment programs.
Right. There are some who resist this because they don't want to fit a stereotype, and also they have worries around, you know, is this the right kind of way of raising a child? And what struck me is that even parents who do this were very self-conscious of the negative implications of what they were doing. So I remember talking with a father who I met about a spelling bee, and he's like, I don't think spelling bees are really worthwhile. And I thought I misheard him because we're sitting at a spelling bee with his, for his child. And he said, you know, yeah, my daughter's doing this, but, you know, the people I think are going to kind of have the best success in life are those who have emotional intelligence, who have social skills. I'm not convinced my kid is learning that here. So I'm making my kid more competitive, but is that really the end goal? I had a mother say, you know, are we raising creative kids? Are we raising compassionate kids? Or are we just raising kids who, you know how to do like more and more learning? And so yet they were still doing it. Like, this was like the conundrum. Like, they knew that this was their, or at least they believed there were negative impacts for this kind of parenting, but they still did it because they were concerned about what it would mean if they don't do it. Would they lose their class status? Would their kid be behind? It's like, you know, having your child in Little League, which, you know, my kids did Little League, and I think it's wonderful, but then thinking, well, maybe my kids need extra coaching on the side. And so now I'm doing extra coaching for my kids, paying for that, even though they should just be fine in Little League. And it's making baseball less fun. It's making it more of a chore. And if you don't do it, right, you're worried what your kid's standing will be on the team otherwise. It's the exact same kind of phenomenon. Here we're seeing it in education.
Now, you reveal your own participation in the book, and I think viewers, readers will appreciate that. But you keep your own two kids busy. What kind of enrichment are they in?
So I actually did this for my kids for a little while, because after I was talking with so many parents, I'm like, maybe I should try this out. And one kid actually quite enjoyed it for a while. One kid, you know, was like, why are you doing this to me? So we pulled out both kids. Like, this is not really worth the added stress that it's causing them. But then for my own kids, you know, we try to, you know, we kind of stumble our way through parenting like everyone else. I have a teenager and a preteen now. And, you know, so we try to give them opportunities to do things outside of school that kind of speak to their particular interests. One of my kids loves the NFL. And so we're always talking about sports. And so the NFL draft happened, like, what, a month ago? So I remember, like, we were planning for that. And I said, why don't you, you know, come up with a draft board? So when we're watching the draft, we can compare it to your predictions. And so he read some websites, and he had to come up with predictions and explain them. And it was really fun for him. My other son loves politics. He loves debating politics. He loves being right about politics. That's what it comes down to. So I will, like, you know, kind of challenge him a lot about that. And like, you know, well, here's the position I will take that I think you have to admit is right, unless you can prove me wrong. No one will disagree with it. And so, you know, it may feel like some work at first, but then it's actually something I'm speaking to their interests, right? That's the goal. Mm-hmm. Right? I understand when parents are concerned around education. I mean, I think our teachers do a great job. I think our schools do a great job. And it's one of the unsung heroes most of the time. But if you're going to do more education, it's to speak from the kid's point of view.
Here again, there is the element of you spent a lot of time talking to Asian Americans, particularly Asian Indian Americans. And I got a brain cramp trying to separate out the things that Asian parents might feel, like whether they want to resist the stereotype or feel a need mm-hmm. to uphold it on behalf of people like them. You make a reference to Asian parents pushing kids as a way not to assimilate. There's a lot to unpack mm-hmm. there.
Yeah, a lot of the parents I spoke to, and what surprised me was that if you hear immigrants say, you know, come to new immigrants to the country, or, you know, even if you've been here for a while, say, I like a lot of things about America, but I don't want my child to become American, full American. Like, that may seem odd, but you can at least appreciate, well, you know, yeah, the things about their cultural heritage they want their kids to maintain, and that's what they mean. And so parents would say, I want my kid to, you know, not fully assimilate. And by that, what they meant is, I want to make sure that, like, you know, like, as I alluded to earlier, if we came to this country as immigrants because we focus so much on education, we want to make sure they do that too. And parents were concerned that, you know, America is a great place. But one father said, I asked him, what do you like about America? He said, oh, where do I start? There's so many things I like about America, the freedoms, the confidence, the opportunities. He went on and on. But it said, but the emphasis on education seems to be less than what I'm comfortable with. And so parents wanted their kids to be in these after-school centers and other such things so that the kids would maintain a commitment to education. That was one of the kind of motivations. But when I spoke to white families who did the same kind of activity, they too would say, I think a lot of Americans aren't taking education seriously enough. And I think that, you know, parents put their kids into activities that are fun, which is great, but they don't put their kids into activities unless the kid really enjoys them. And parents aren't putting their kids in activities that may be good for them, but aren't always fun. And a lot of white parents were worried about that, too. It's like having, you know, the green vegetable on the side of your plate, which no one really wants, but you put it there anyway. They saw the same. This is basically adding a green vegetable to their kids' extracurricular lives, which I thought was essential, right, for a well-nutritious kind of upbringing, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. And what struck me also was that along the same lines about pushing kids in certain directions, college admissions officers that I spoke with were somewhat hesitant to endorse this kind of extracurricular commitment. They actually believed that it didn't help kids necessarily, and which I write a good amount about, and that parents could be doing their kids a disservice if they're giving them more education, whether it be just through, you know, online or in person or wherever else, if the motivation is college entry. That's not how college admissions officers wanted parents to pursue this. They didn't think they would help them in the long run. So there's a lot of misconceptions around this.
Well, that's interesting. So you got the colleges themselves saying, hey, we want really smart people, but maybe not this way.
Exactly. Exactly. Wow. And at the same time, the parents who are doing this are saying, you know, I see my kids' grades improve. I see their confidence go up. I saw a lot of mothers say, I want my daughters in particular to be doing this because confidence for girls in math goes down in middle school and in high school. And these mothers who were not themselves mathematicians, they were just in various kinds of jobs or stay-at-home mothers, say, I want my daughters to be confident in math, so I'm going to have them in this extra math class in fourth, fifth grade, sixth grade, so that when it comes to seventh, eighth grade, they're not going to fall behind. Because the parents weren't dwelling on college entry per se. They were dwelling on making sure our kids have opportunities, and they want to have all the opportunities that they can, and the confidence that comes with that. And so there's a disconnect between how the college admissions officers see it, how the teachers see it, but, and also why the parents do it. And I was trying to bring out so we can better understand, right? And then we can parent and educate from a positive place, right? As opposed to a place that's based on misconceptions and misalignments.
Let's take another phone call. John in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Pavan Dingra, the author of Hyper Education.
Thanks. Good topic. Is it possible college is overrated? You know, most, about 20 to 25% of Americans have a college degree. Doesn't mean the other 75% are somehow, you know, losers or something. There's all sorts of jobs out there that don't require college. And I guess that's beyond the status of sending your kid to a really cool college. The practical side of it is, I don't know. What do you think?
All right. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's actually a good reminder that, which I talk about, and I ask a lot of parents about, like, why are you so committed to college as, for instance, the one way to, you know, be okay in life and to feel economical. So, as the caller said, you know, 3/4 of Americans don't have college degrees, and they're not, you know, ignorant people. And the parents would say, you know, yeah, I agree with that. If my kid doesn't want to go to college and wants to come, you know, after high school, start something or get a job, that's great. But I want to give them the opportunities to have these college as an option if that's what they choose. And a lot of the parents I spoke to were college educated, so they had that in mind for their kids. But one of the ways in which this still applies, whether or not your kids go to college or not, is this notion of, well, they don't need to go to college, but I still want them to be as educated as they can at the age at which they're in. And a lot of, you know, developmental growth for children that happens in young ages from 0 through 5 is when a lot of the brain grows the most rapidly. And parents were aware of this. So they wanted to give their kids as much opportunities to learn, even if college was not down the road, at a younger age.
You do reference this in the book in the second chapter, the concept that, you know, maybe parents wouldn't be doing this if the schools were doing more. And I don't know what kind of time span you had in the parents you talked to, whether some had watched kids long enough to watch the changes. But there's certainly been the rise of standardized testing and the sense of trying to make sure that kids in every state match up about the same. And I know I talked to enough educators who feel like there's been downward pressure on what is taught than to teach up to the test, which was a fear expressed many years ago. I mean, is part of what you're seeing here a reaction then to what public schools have been doing?
So, yeah, a lot of the parents believe that they were in. What struck me was that a lot of parents would say, we're in good schools. I like my school. But, oh, it's not nearly doing enough. And there's no way they could do enough. And so parents weren't trying to chastise the school or their teachers per se, but believe that, you know, the pressure to teach to the test and standardized curriculums limited what teachers could do. And so it didn't make sense as a parent to complain to the teacher that, oh, can you give Johnny more math or more reading? Because they felt the teachers were constrained by the regulations. And so I'll just take this into my own hands. As a parent, I'll just take it into my own hands. But what a lot of parents are missing is that actually our schools are doing quite a good job. Right, and even compared to international standards, it's hard to really know, but there's a good reason to believe that, you know, our better schools are actually teaching our kids quite well, and yet a lot of these after school centers and the rest would kind of argue that, you know, your kids aren't learning enough and your schools aren't teaching properly, so you need to come to us in order to get the education that you need. And we're seeing that not just from marketing from private companies, but you see, you know, politicians complain about this. You see pundits complain about our education. So parents have a lot of reasons to be worried about the quality of their kids' school, even if the quality actually is quite good.
You know, the book gets to its most abstract when you talk about a push upon parents from neoliberalism. Will you elaborate on that point and how neoliberalism differs from regular old liberalism?
Yeah. It's a small part of the book. I want listeners to know what the book's going through. But yeah, there's an important part in that a lot of parents and all of us, right, have the sense of wanting more opportunities for our kids, and that's great. But the added element of that is that if we don't take advantage of those opportunities, and if you don't help your kids become the best they can be, then somehow you did not do a good job as a parent. We should be relying, you know, not on the government or on social services, but the expectation is to rely just on yourselves in order to educate our kids and give them the best that we can do. That's kind of a neoliberal mindset. And so what that means then, in terms of parenting, is that as a parent, I really have to seek out and make use of whatever options I can for my kids, because otherwise, and if the kids don't do well, I'm to blame. You can't blame anyone else, because I did not take advantage of the opportunities that were ahead of me in order to give my kid the best learning or training or whatever else that they could, so they could become the right kind of person. So this notion that you're in charge of your own destiny, you have to take advantage of opportunities, and no one's there to kind of help you otherwise, that's a growing kind of, if you will, neoliberal approach, which is not just an economic kind of philosophy, but it's filtered down into how we parent, right, into how we approach our relationships, and that's what part of the book quickly explains.
All right, so a sense of it's on you, you know, you the parent have
us,
to make,
right.
Yeah, okay. So I just wonder, you get into stuff like talking about the Scripps National Spelling Bee, and mm-hmm. It is kind of funny that when it's on, it wasn't this year because of the COVID-19,
right.
that it's on ESPN. I mean, so it sort of heightens the level of competition, but in a way it also does at least celebrate smartness.
Right. Yeah, I think it's really wonderful that it's on ESPN and that, you know, one of the kids I spoke with called it the brain sport. That was brilliant. And the parents I spoke to and kids I spoke to, they love the fact that it's on ESPN. And a lot of kids would say, I don't really care if I win the spelling bee. I just want to make it to ESPN. Because they only broadcast like the last 50 or so panelists. And so it's a real treat for them. And it's not just because it's on TV, but because it's a sports channel, right? And these kids, they love sports. A lot of them love sports. They play sports. But they also think about spelling bees and math competitions and anything else as a kind of sport. So really quickly, a lot of them would say, you know, spelling is the most brutal of sports. Because if you're playing basketball and you miss 10 shots, but you make 10 more shots, that's still not a bad game. But in spelling, if you miss one letter, whether it's the school level spelling bee, the regional, the state level, or the national level, you miss one letter at any one of those moments, you're done for the whole year, right? So it's really like unforgiving, and even worse than other sports. And so, yeah, they had a lot of references to sports, which I really loved hearing, and I draw out. One kid, after he won the Scripps spelling bee, threw up his arms in the form of an X, which was in reference to a favorite football player at the time, a guy named Des Bryant, who's now retired. There's all these sports elements throughout the book.
More competition then, but you have many moving parts to what you talk about in hyper-education: ethnic identification, competition, cultural norms. You've already identified some of what you think might need to change here, which is making sure that you take the kids' interests into account. But the current immigration strategy under the Trump administration is to bring in more skilled people. Basically, you got to have some kind of good education to be able to get into the country. If this is something that happens a lot from immigrants, it seems like we're potentially having an expansion of hyper-education desires, or at least a steady growth of it in the future.
Yeah, I think this is going to be the new normal. And I say that with, you know, not like a lot of glee necessarily, but the immigrants coming in, as you already alluded to, right, are going to be educated immigrants for the most part, college educated. And then again, how do they get to be college educated and get to come to the U.S.? Not just by relying on what the school taught them, but going above and beyond. And then you couple that with the fact that, you know, all kinds of parents, you know, U.S.-born parents are also seeking this out, whether it be just now in our COVID moment or before this, when these are already kind of the fastest growing tutoring companies in the country or the fastest growing companies. So you have this kind of perfect storm of factors that's going to make this a huge growth segment. And as some parents do it, other parents feel compelled to do it also just to keep up. And that's going to be more and more what we expect. And so I'm trying to help people understand is why are parents doing this and what are the drawbacks and what are the benefits, right? It's not just bad, but it's definitely not just good. And we have to understand that there are serious drawbacks depending on not just if you do it, but how you do it. Mm-hmm. Right? A lot of lessons have been learned about how to go about this.
Well, you're a very efficient writer. You've packed a lot of stuff into the book, and it's really a surprisingly easy read for all of that. The book is called Hyper Education: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. It's the work of Pavan Dhingra, sociologist and professor at Amherst College in Massachusetts. Pavan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, take care.